Thanks very much, John. You know, it's getting to be springtime in Atlanta, and in the mornings, I'm woken up by a bird right outside my window, and it says, "Jeter, Jeter, Jeter." It's flown all the way from New York to say that. Bill Foege talked about the ultimate feeling of powerlessness of being when you're in a taxi. And that's particularly true in New York City, but I think it's true all over the world. And it reminded me of one of the most frightening experiences of my life. My wife and I had gotten back from a trip overseas, a nice relaxing vacation, many years ago, before we had kids, about 20 years ago, I guess. And the taxi driver cut in the taxi line, because it was one of his first days of work, to pick up rides at JFK. And I guess he had done it because he didn't realize that was not done at JFK. And the dispatcher said, "I have your number, I have your license, you will never get another ride at this, and I'm going to get, you know, to have, take lots of action," because he, you know, scared the guy. The guy was about 18 years old. And he drove back at about 115 miles an hour. And we didn't know, you know, if we had said, "Sir, could you please slow down," that could have caused even more problems. So going down the FDR Drive at 3 in the morning at 115 miles an hour with a cab driver who's about 18 years old, having his first day on the job, and who, you know, thought his life was coming to an end by this, was a bit of the feeling of powerlessness that I think some of our clients feel in their lives day in and day out, and the challenges they have to take control of their lives and live in a way that's going to be affirming to themselves and their families and their partners and their communities. Sir William Osler, as many of you know, was essentially the founder of modern medicine. In 1882, he wrote the first textbook of medicine that was a true textbook of medicine, and with that single book, revolutionized the way we think about disease and medicine. It was the first time there had been a systematization of the different disease entities. Before then, it had been fever or ague. but with Osler's Principles and Practice of Medicine, 1882, he had extensive chapters on syphilis, tuberculosis, high blood pressure, the panoply of health problems, drawn from his extensive experience not just treating patients, but doing over 1,000 autopsies personally, so that he understood what the pathology was underlying the conditions and had reviewed a pretty substantial medical literature that existed even then. It was an age when someone who worked essentially constantly could encompass all of medicine and summarize it in a textbook. And he had very specific views on syphilis. And as you know, syphilis was, in effect, the AIDS of that day. It was untreatable. It was fatal. It was transmissible from a husband to wife or partner, from mother to child. It was devastating. And Osler wrote the following in his section on syphilis. And I thought it was worth revisiting it as we think about the increased risk behaviors among men who have sex with men. "Personal purity," Osler wrote, "is the prophylaxis which we as physicians are especially bound to advocate. Continence may be a hard condition, to some harder than others, but it can be borne. And it is our duty to urge this lesson upon young and old who seek our advice in matters sexual. Certainly it is better to marry than to burn, but if the former is not feasible, there are other altars than those of Venus upon which a young man may light fires. Hard work of body and hard work of mind. Idleness is the mother of lechery. And a young man will find that absorption in any pursuit will do much. The cool passions which, though natural and proper, cannot in the exigencies of our civilization always obtain natural and proper gratification." The next section of this is a discussion of prostitution and the need to ensure that it is regulated and recognize that it will always be with us, but I've left that part out. The way I think about health is to think of, from the most basic factors that affect health, that have the largest impact on health, socioeconomic factors like poverty, housing, education, work, to things that change the context, that make individuals' default decisions healthier, to protective interventions, to clinical interventions, and to counseling, with less and less impact with each of these. We don't yet have a vaccine for HIV, we do for HPV, so we work to try to change what we can change of those. Changing the social norm is going to be critically important to addressing HIV. I became a doctor in New York City in the early 1980s, and I did my residency in New York City in the early to mid-1980s, and I took care of hundreds of men who died from AIDS and for whom I could do almost nothing. That experience changed the norm for a generation of men who grew up seeing their friends die and drastically reduced risk-taking behavior. With the advent of effective antiretroviral therapy in 1996, we have a generation of men who have grown up not seeing their friends die, and that's a good thing. But it means that we have many more challenges. And until we're able to begin to change the norm through changing all of the things that affect that norm, we're going to be enormously challenged with the resurgence of syphilis and HIV among men who have sex with men, and among the women who are infected by them. For all of us working in HIV, I ask you to remember that, for all of us working in STDs, I ask you to remember that HIV is the infection that's going to kill people. It is the highest priority for our actions. It is what will make the biggest difference in our efforts. Changing the social norm is not easy, but ubiquitous condoms and powerful safe sex messages wherever risky sex is arranged or occurs is one way to try to do that. Consistent clinical care, we know, reduces the risk of unsafe sex. And clearly, there's a need for community education to reduce risky behavior. Prevention is the best buy in the health sector. In clinical practice and community policy can increase health value for health dollars. And I think this is a very important argument for us to make. It's a very important point for us to demonstrate with data and to come back to over and over and over again. Because unfortunately, over the coming years, we're going to face lean times. We have, stretching as far into the future as we can see, significant budget deficits at the federal, state, and local levels. We have increasing social needs at the federal, state, and local levels. And we're going to have to face that very unpleasant reality and understand that there are going to be enormous pressures to reduce expenditures. We're going to have to show that we're a best buy in the health sector. We can show that prevention can reduce per capita annual costs and that health reform can be transformational in recognizing the importance of prevention, both in terms of coverage for preventive care, preventive funding, and support for public health infrastructure. But we also have to face the fact that we're losing the battle against HIV among men who have sex with men. This figure from a paper published in JAMA a few years ago shows what has happened over the years. In the early 80s, new HIV infections among men who have sex with men reached a peak of close to 80,000, came down, and then starting around the time HART became available, has increased steadily. In contrast, we've been quite successful at drastically reducing transmission among injection drug users and among joint MSM-IDU groups. And heterosexual transmission increased till about 1990 and has stayed, unfortunately, relatively constant since then. Not only is the situation bad, but in many communities it is getting worse. 3/4 of participants reported multiple partners, and half reported unprotected anal intercourse in the past year, particularly younger men. And the reflection of that is what's happening with estimated rates of new HIV infection, which are many times higher in African American men and significantly higher in Hispanic men, and still far too high in all men in the US and throughout the world where HIV is spreading. There are a couple of things that we think can make a big difference. First, increasing the proportion of Americans, and particularly HIV positive Americans, that should say, who know their HIV status. The estimates from the CDC still are that around a fifth or a quarter of HIV positive individuals don't know their status. We don't fully know where we are with that. I think in different communities it's quite different. We do know that knowing your status is important. Knowledge is power. And men who know their status reduce their risk behaviors by about half. They also can get care and prevent progression to AIDS and engage in prevention activities. Linkage to care is critically important. Many newly diagnosed people don't promptly seek care, and that's a real lost opportunity for treatment and prevention. And many people who are in care are lost to care periodically. And if someone chooses not to take treatment or engage in care, that is entirely their choice. But if the government doesn't make an effort through community partners or clinical service providers to engage that individual and invite them back into care and encourage them to resume treatment, I think that is dereliction of duty on the part of the government. We need to work with people who are HIV positive to reduce risky behavior. And there's lots of models here that can be more effective. We're not doing this as extensively as we could. We have a gap between prevention and treatment that's problematic. And in particular, to reduce unprotected anal intercourse, which is causing the overwhelming majority, not just of MSM cases, but a significant minority in all likelihood of heterosexually transmitted cases, something that is generally unknown to the general public. At one point, every sexually transmitted case of HIV was a result of an HIV discordant relationship. So we need to think hard about how can we make a big difference in reducing risk behavior. Syphilis is a harbinger of the increased risk, almost entirely among men who have sex with men. This increase, which has been more in urban areas and other places, is a sentinel health event. It tells us that there is life-threatening, risky sex occurring. The resurgence began almost a decade ago, and has been substantial, and is overwhelmingly among men who have sex with men. Chlamydia is an area where we have much better testing methodologies and where we can probably do a great deal more. But there are still things that we don't know and more things that we need to do. Screening has increased, but could increase much more. A collaboration with the medical care field is very important to increase awareness of screening. Social marketing to make young women more aware of long-term consequences, and expedited partner treatment, which models suggest could possibly reduce chlamydia prevalence by up to 30 to 40%. HPV, where we do have a vaccine, which is getting steady uptake, quite variable in different parts of the country, but quite substantial for HPV uptake. Nationally, about 37%. So, this will have major benefits in the medium and long terms. There are key issues in STD control, and you know them better than I do, but I want to mention a few of them that I think sometimes don't get the attention they need or deserve. The first is alcohol. It's been claimed, and it may well be true, that alcohol is responsible for more HIV infections than illicit drugs. And we often ignore the harms that alcohol does. A large proportion of our STD clinic attendees have alcohol problems. We know that alcohol availability in a community is associated with gonorrhea rates and is linked to risky behavior among people with HIV. And we know that alcohol prevention policies, including programs to reduce binge drinking, can be effective. Alcohol screening and brief intervention at STD clinics could potentially reduce STDs. We don't yet have evidence of this, but I know you had a presentation earlier from New York City where a very large-scale brief intervention program was undertaken to have all STD clinic attendees self-screen using a simple questionnaire and then use a dedicated staff to do brief intervention to make a difference. What is brief intervention? It's 3 to 5 minutes, maybe 10 or 15, but not much counseling to change the trajectory of problem drinking. And the evidence base is quite strong. It's not going to help someone who's already been alcoholic with lots of alcohol-related damage for many years, in all likelihood. But for the people who are at risk of developing alcohol-related harms, it reduces that risk by 40 to 50%. There's not a lot we can do in 5, 10, or 15 minutes that can have that kind of an impact on people's lives. And in New York City, they've now had counselors do brief intervention on many thousands of people with problem drinking. And I'm eagerly awaiting the results of the analysis, which will determine whether those who received brief intervention were less likely to come back with a recurrent STD in the future, either there or elsewhere in the city. Family planning and STD prevention need to be much better coordinated than they are now. We know that there are family planning clinics that have been doing a good job of increasing their STD screening and treatment. We know that there are STD clinics that are increasing their family planning activities, but more needs to be done. Also, more needs to be done to promote dual protection. Basically, males use a condom, females use either hormonal contraceptives or IUD. And we need to ensure that there are adequate resources because we know that, as I said in the opening session, STD tends to be substantially underfunded. And family planning also tends to be inaccessible and underfunded. A third key area for focus is the online world. Online hookups are related to increased risk of sexual activity. Men who use the internet and seek sex with men are among the biggest recent influences on risk activity. This is where it's at. And if we're not there, we're not going to be able to influence the risky behaviors that are occurring. About 40% of MSM seek sexual relationships online, and people who do so have more partners and a higher likelihood of meeting HIV-positive partners and of having unprotected anal intercourse. I know that there are many programs that are doing creative things with the internet. We need to do much, much more. We've been slow to adapt to a rapidly changing online environment. Only 19 out of 67 programs do internet-based partner services, although guidelines for those have been out for 3 years. Tailoring information to the online consumer is very important. If it's more than about a fragment of a sentence, it's too long. Promoting a healthy online community and partnering with social media organizations to promote sexual health are all ways to go. But we need to be creative. We need to figure out what to do. We need to work hard to evaluate what we're doing here. There are ways to do this. And there are ways to use the online technologies to support our work. In New York City, Tom Farley, my successor there, helped the HIV program design an internet survey of unprotected anal intercourse with a way of doing that using the online dating sites so that we would have quarter to quarter real-time information on the rate of condom use and the rate of unsafe unprotected anal intercourse, which was the key behavior that we need to work to reduce. we need to engage the healthcare delivery system more to increase prevention impact. Most STDs are reported, and even more are diagnosed in non-STD clinical settings. In New York City, we began screening for chlamydia in the jails at Rikers Island. And within a year, the correctional system was treating more chlamydia patients than all of our STD clinics combined. The primary care system needs to be engaged. Managed care providers need to increase their efforts. We need to strengthen STD prevention efforts to increase population impact. And we know that with health reform, there would be important opportunities for prevention. Coverage of core preventive services, community-based prevention, and increased access to electronic health records, both to trigger effective diagnosis and treatment and to monitor processes and outcomes. When I started at CDC, I identified five key priorities, and I may well be wrong, but I'm sticking with those five. So I wanted to just spend a minute mentioning them and talk also about how they may apply to STD prevention and control. The first, to improve surveillance, epidemiology, and laboratory services. All of public health starts with surveillance. There's a lot that we don't know and we need to know. We need to have real-time systems to monitor UAI among MSM. We need to understand the epidemiology of HIV and STDs better than we do currently. And we need laboratory work using existing tools and new tools as well. Second, CDC is committed to better supporting state, tribal, local, and territorial public health, because this is where the work happens. This is where the difference between success and failure will be made. And CDC was created as an institution to support state and local health departments, and that's what I'm committed to helping us do with increasing effectiveness in the months and years to come. We need to increase our global health impact. We have substantial activities in global health. 2.4 million people are being treated for HIV because of PEPFAR. This is a remarkable success. It has transformed communities and countries in Africa from areas where there was just an unspeakable devastation to areas where they're beginning to be able to deal with a terrible, terrible AIDS pandemic. There have also been important progress made in some countries on HIV prevention. But there are lots of areas in global health where we need to work. And STDs generally have been neglected in the global health arena. We need to affect policies that affect health. So addressing health reform, addressing things like expedited partner therapy in STD control will be critically important. Making sure that people who want to learn their HIV status can do so readily will be critically important. Ensuring that people have access to prevention and treatment will be critically important. And through all these means to better prevent illness, disability, and death. Now, Bill Foege talked about the sense of powerlessness that is felt by a significant proportion of people in our society and throughout the world. And I think back to that cab ride at 110 miles an hour down the FDR Drive in New York City, and I think about the lives that many people who we care for are living day in and day out. We need to do two things. First, implement specific programs that will make a difference in people's lives. Treatment of HIV, treatment of STDs, vaccination, brief intervention, counseling, linkage to care, so that for everyone who we touch, we try to increase their sense of control over their lives. And second, we need to work with our partners in the community, in government, in civil society, in academia, to change the structures of our society to promote health, to encourage people to be able to take a healthy interest in their present, in their future, so that they can work toward a life that will be fulfilling. Some of the most difficult and challenging interactions that we have are with people who say, what does it matter that I will get HIV? I've got much more pressing problems. What does it matter that I get HIV? Because I don't know that I'm going to be alive in 10 or 20 years anyway. Those two perspectives are not in conflict. They're synergistic. With those two perspectives, we can help empower individuals one-on-one and empower communities one community at a time. Thank you very much.
Dr. Frieden, thank you. That was incredible and a great vision for our future. Dr. Frieden is busy, but he's got time for a few questions. So this is your chance as he begins his first year, or is completing his first year as our director, to share your perspectives and questions. This microphone here.
Hi, I'm... is this on? Hello?
Yep.
I'm Jim Bogner with the American Psychological Association. Can you tell us what is the status of the National AIDS Strategy, and are you happy with it?
Well, it's not yet defined, so I can't be happy or unhappy, but Dr. Fenton is intimately involved with the development of that, of the National AIDS Strategy. I think the key point is that we're committed, the administration is committed to establishing a strategy that is most likely to succeed. And that's the goal of all of the effort, with a lot of community consultation and a lot of focus on what do we know, what can we make a difference with. And I think over the coming months, we'll see that play out, and Dr. Fenton can give you more details on that.
Over to the right.
Hello, am I on?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Holly Howard from the California Department of STD Control Branch. And I was just wondering, a lot of the issues that you've discussed are important not just to CDC, but to other federal health agencies. And I wanted to hear about some of your ideas about partnering with the other federal agencies, not just around pooling resources around health issues that we can all agree on, but also around data standardization. You know, we've been talking some of our presentations about how Ryan White, for instance, is mandating unique identifiers with reporting, and how much we could gain for that if we had that in our reporting requirements, you know, across OPA, Title 10, HRSA, et cetera. You know, and also about around reducing barriers around funding streams. And I'm thinking specifically around patient-delivered partner therapy. We've been lobbying a lot for the legalization of this. However, there's no funding mechanisms right now to support it. And even though we've shown that it's effective for the index patient, there's still, Medicaid has these barriers still in place that don't allow us to bring that that service back to the index patient and say, no, this is actually for the protection of this patient as opposed to this her partner. So I just want to know some of your thoughts.
Terrific points, great suggestions. One thing I've been really encouraged by over the past 9 months is the tremendous collegiality within the government. I've met with Mary Wakefield of HRSA multiple times. Our staff are meeting. We're intensifying the partnership that we have with them, and I think we have really great opportunities to get much more synergy than there has been until now. I've met with Cindy Mann of Medicaid, and we've begun to outline some of the issues. In those five priorities I mentioned, one of them is policy, and getting reimbursement for partner-delivered therapy is a great example of that. It's something that makes a lot of sense, make a big difference, but not easy to get that through Medicaid. And the fiscal pressures on the states on Medicaid will be quite substantial. So showing that this is cheaper than seeing the partner is a key way to get that through. We have to learn the best by data and the best by language, because that's what we're going to be able to run with at this point. Thank you for those suggestions. Please keep the suggestions coming through your programs. We need good ideas that we can advocate for on your behalf.
I just want to acknowledge Dr. Frieden has been incredibly interested in looking for opportunities to address questions like that. He's really proactively asked us to funnel suggestions to him, as he just said. So you guys on the ground are often so much more aware than we are, and I want to acknowledge that he's walking that walk. Stuart.
I just want to say this conference, I'm with the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention, and I'm very appreciative for this conference. It's been amazing, and I'm glad to see some of our colleagues from DHAP here at an STD conference under the leadership of Dr. Douglas, Dr. Fenton. We're talking about sexual health and other important things. At the client level, I think, as we all know, there are people with multiple needs, whether it's tuberculosis, hepatitis, STDs, including HIV. And so I do think that Dr. Fenton has really been pushing program collaboration and service integration. It happens, but people don't often think about it as much as they should, again, going to the client level. My question is, HIV, as we all know, is an STD most of the time, and yet at our level, the state level, many people have programs that are collaborating, that have merged. I'm wondering if there are ways at the CDC level that people do care about all these infections, the 25 plus STDs, but is there a way we can collaborate and coordinate even more where HIV and STD are together and not viewed separately?
Again, I would look to Dr. Fenton for his leadership on this issue. There have been a lot of times that this has been looked at, and I think we need to think carefully about what makes sense. Clearly, in some areas, partner notification is done much better for STDs than for HIV, and that's a problem. Partner notification isn't going to turn the HIV epidemic around overnight, but it's a solid, important tool that we need to use much more than we're doing now. And this is one area where I think we really need to look at the interactions between HIV and STD programs. There are other areas as well. HIV is the to be very blunt, the rich older brother of STD, or younger brother, yes, thank you. Much younger. I think we need to think about how STD care that reduces HIV can be done better by pooling resources. There are lots of other areas of interaction. I think some of them will be very specific to individual places, but from my vantage point, having been New York City Health Commissioner for nearly 8 years, it was frustrating to see things in our STD world that would prevent HIV very effectively not happening for lack of funds, while sometimes lower priority things were being done with HIV dollars. And I think that's something we all have to work to change.
Hi, I'm Kathy Chin from the Minnesota Department of Health, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the paradigm shift towards focusing on sexual health, and if that paradigm shift is going to go beyond just the STD world and through CDC to other parts like maternal child health, the HIV, any others that you think might be appropriate.
We have to see how it goes, I think. We have to see if, you know, rebranding or reframing is going to have specific programmatic differences. Ultimately, there's a lot of basic stuff that we have to get right. Diagnosis, treatment, partner notification, surveillance, epidemiology, laboratory work, on-the-ground work. And if this is a tool that helps us do that better, then great. And I think we need to see that over the next couple of years.
Hi, Anna O'Leary from DHAP at CDC. One of the points that you made was that by far the greatest amount of variance in health outcomes is accounted for by socioeconomic and other social determinants of health. And this affects not only infectious disease, but virtually every health outcome that you can think of, for example, is related to poverty. And you know, some of us at CDC are engaged in one notable case, a cross-center collaboration to mount a micro-enterprise project. And are finding it very, very difficult with the way that CDC is currently structured. And you know, the interventions, the social determinants of health type interventions are very expensive and they can influence many aspects of health. So it's something that it makes a lot of sense for us to try to do. So I'm wondering whether you'd be open to some discussions about how we could, as an agency, better mount such interventions and possibly even discussions about changing the organization of the agency somewhat.
So we've just gone through a realignment of agency structures. I don't think we're going to do much more of that anytime soon. I think there are a couple of key roles of public health as related to social determinants of health. One is to bear witness. And we have committed to begin producing a periodic report on health inequalities as a essentially a surveillance summary, something that's critically important and that we will do in this calendar year. Second, we need to identify specific programs that will make a difference in social determinants of health. And I think reducing HIV is one of them, because it has such a pervasive negative effect on communities. Another is reducing teen and unintended pregnancy. This is something that could be done much more effectively than it's being done in our society, and which would have an enormous impact on reducing the social consequences and the intergenerational transmission of poverty. So I think key roles are bearing witness and doing specific things that will make a specific impact. We go to the next person.
Hi, thank you. I was amused by your slide from Dr. Osler, as I assume I was meant to be. But then I remembered that actually that is a lot of the policy that we've been following in terms of sexuality education came right out of that slide. And I think the jury is pretty much in on abstinence-only education and that it doesn't work, and yet we're still throwing a lot of resources at it. So is that, as we all deal with, and all these other questions are being asked, with our strapped resources, is that some place that we can, say, well, we're not going to do that anymore because it doesn't make any sense? And in that spirit, what are we going to be doing to make sure that the things that we do are scientific and evidence-based and not political?
Yeah, so I should clarify that I presented that quotation really to talk about human nature rather than to promote abstinence.
No, I didn't think you were doing it, but I think right. It's like, but ironically, that is a national education priority and a lot of dollars. Right.
We're very committed to taking programs where the data takes them. And to rigorously evaluating the programs that are being implemented so that we can scale up those that are working and defend them, and we can fix the ones that aren't working. And I think as we look at HIV prevention, we need to look rigorously at what's making a difference. That's why the first need in public health is surveillance, epidemiology, and lab services, so that we can figure out what's working, where we have evidence, then scale it up.
Kevin.
I'll say that one of the things that President Obama has said is that supporting science is about ensuring that facts and evidence are never twisted or obscured by politics or ideology. I've got that on my wall. And I think with that as our guide, we can accomplish great things. We're going to have time for only, I'll take the four people who are up, but that's
right,
it.
Four more. Okay. Kevin.
Good morning.
Uh-oh.
Can you take six?
If you can ask one sentence questions that I can make one sentence answers to, yes.
Don't forget us over here. Good morning. Bruce Strig, New Mexico, Department of Health. We have decades to make up for a lack of harm reduction programs in the United States. How can the CDC take a lead on this?
Well, I think first, in terms of syringe exchange, this is now something that will become possible with federal dollars for the first time, assuming everything gets finalized. In terms of sexual harm reduction, I think we're thinking about serosorting as an important, for people who are HIV positive, as an important potential way of reducing risk behavior, something that we haven't forthrightly advocated for before. But we need to move forward on things that take the world as it is, not as we wish it would be, and implement effective programs based on that.
Thanks.
Good morning. Bernice Tucker, Executive Director of Women Accepting Responsibility in Baltimore, Maryland. One thing that really concerns me is that you're saying more money should be put into surveillance data. You want to be able to see the true picture. We see graphically from the data exactly what's happening. We hear all the time that the money should follow the epidemic. I don't understand why CDC, knowing all of this, has not set women as a priority. That's my number one concern. Then the other concern I have is that we're one of those funded by CDC for counseling, testing, and referral. So we know that hepatitis is probably more prevalent than HIV. And in Maryland, every year, we are faced with testing people in June and not being able to get the results from the lab because the lab has run out of money. The other thing that concerns me is that Women Accepting Responsibility is a gender-specific organization. And so that's why I'm really concerned about women being a priority, as well as knowing that it will make a difference. But we also know that women closet drinkers.
Right. So if you don't ask a quick question, other people won't be able to ask
a question. Well, that's it. That's okay. All of it.
Okay.
We know that women are closet drinkers. So we know about a lot of issues that are happening with women, but we're not seeing any program specifically to put in the forefront to address them as far as interventions. I know about Sister. We have Sister. We have a Willow. We have quite a few of your Debbies.
So saying that surveillance is crucially important is not necessarily saying more dollars need to go into surveillance. It's saying that it's the fundamental part of public health. And yes, it should be the basis for not just our resource allocation decisions, but our program implementation decisions on
Absolutely.
What we scale up and scale back. And HIV, I think you're quite right, is not one epidemic. It's many epidemics.
Right.
Even in one city or one community, it's many epidemics. And the key to success is going to be addressing those epidemics, including critical issues like alcohol, separately in different communities.
What about women being a priority?
I just said they were. Thanks very much.
They were?
Yes, they are. They.
Good morning. My name is Kevin O'Connor. I'm the chief of the program training branch in the Division of STD Prevention.
Actually, you know something? I'm going to ask that non-CDC staff, if they're non-CDC staff, I can answer CDC staff's questions anytime, and I'm going to have to go 3 minutes ago or 5 minutes ago. So could I take your question here?
My name is Samuel Frimpong from Duval County Health Department in Jacksonville AIDS program. We know that in the large cities, the caseload of STD and HIV for disease intervention specialists are enormous. And we also know for a fact that physicians can help clients to modify their behavior. An example is tobacco cessation programs. What efforts or what plans do you have for physicians to actively engage non-previous HIV positive who continuously get recurrent STDs, especially syphilis? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an enormous challenge, and I know how frustrating it is for public health workers all over the country. I don't know what's more frustrating, the difficulty of working with physicians or the difficulty of working with individuals who have recurrent STDs and continue to engage in risky behaviors. But both are very frustrating, and there are, I'm sorry to say, no easy answers to that, and I think you probably from the depth with which you asked that question, know the challenges and some of the opportunities, which include looking at ways to prioritize our caseloads and ensure that we're having the most impact with the people we can have impact with, working as effectively as we can with the healthcare system, and this can be very challenging. When I started at CDC, one of my mentors said to me, you know, that between academic medical centers and public health institutions, there's a long tradition of mutual disrespect. And we need to overcome that. We need to figure out ways that the healthcare system and the public health system can work together optimally. Unfortunately, we're in an era of decreased resources, and decreased resources really for everyone. So the clinicians are dealing with having to have more patients. We hope that electronic health records can provide some assistance in flagging additional needs and in helping to coordinate care within communities, providing evidence-based prevention support, but that's unproven. So I think the question you raise is an enormous challenge for all of us to figure out how can we be more effective with stable or even decreasing resources that we may be facing over the coming years. We should, of course, advocate always for more resources. I'm not saying we shouldn't or that we won't be successful, but given the scope of the problem at the local, state, and national levels in terms of the economic situation, we have to be realistic and to think hard about whether there are ways that we can get more resources by billing better. And this is something that many STD programs are looking at to get Medicaid dollars in. Whether there are things that we're doing now that maybe we can stop doing because they're not as high priority as other things that we need to do, and whether there are things that we can do more efficiently by collaborating or having regional activities. Sir, final question.
Thank you. Kyle Bernstein, San Francisco. Yesterday at the late breaker session, some data was presented showing that MSM have rates of HIV and syphilis almost 50 times higher than other men. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the expansion of the health disparities paradigm to include sexual minorities, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgenders.
That's a great point. Thank you very much. I can tell you that one of the things that we did in New York City was to begin systematically collecting data on health of men who have sex with men, women who have sex with women. And it was a new experience for many of our survey teams. And the data that we received varied in ways that we could not explain. From year to year, with no change in the question, maybe the placement of the question in the survey, so not easy, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. And I think a critically important issue is to be community specific. People talk about the community sometimes, but there is no the community. There are many communities that make up our society, and we need surveillance and monitoring of the challenges and the strengths in different communities, monitoring of the programs that we implement in different communities, monitoring the effectiveness of those programs, so that if they're working, we can learn the lesson, defend the program, and expand it to other areas. And if they're not working, we can be honest about that and fix it, because the needs are there whether or not the program is working. Thank you all very much for the terrific work you do year in and year out.
Dr. Frieden, thanks so much. Worth your weight in gold. That was great. I'd like to invite Dr. Marazzo, my co-chair of the conference, to join me up here as we bring this incredible proceeding to a close.
I'll be brief. I really just want to take this opportunity to thank everybody for participating in this conference. I really believe that this conference is unique. I go to a lot of meetings, a lot of scientific meetings, a lot of program meetings, and I think that the diversity and interdisciplinary nature of this conference really is unusual, and a lot of people have told me that this week. So I really, again, thank you for the opportunity to share our successes, whether in presenting new research findings or new innovations in program that really help us deliver services to our clients and our target populations. And I also really want to, again, thank John, who was a wonderful experience, as always, and Judy and Lynn for really putting together a wonderful conference, as well as Dr. Fenton. With that, I want to ask Darren Ogburn to come up for a moment to just make a brief announcement.
Thanks, Jeannie. It's a little more than brief, so pulling out my notes. Unfortunately, Dr. Frieden's left. I'm going to send him an email later. I come from Atlanta. I will say that most of the folks from Atlanta have accents, as do birds. And the bird that is whispering in his ear in the morning is actually saying chipper, chipper. I digress. About 5 years ago, most of you guys know that I was asked by John to become the deputy director for the Division of STD Prevention. I think he took a big chance by asking me to fulfill this role. It's a big one, have huge shoes to fill, and my feet aren't terribly big. When I accepted this charge, I delved headfirst into the inquisitive world of John Douglas. Most of you guys know this. John is, he's a questioner. He likes to ask a lot of questions. Our partnership between the deputy director and the division director will evolve in about a week and a half. And it's been mentioned over the last few days that this transition is bittersweet. And in fact, I'm not creative enough to come up with another synonym than that, so bittersweet it is. It's bittersweet for me specifically because there are some new challenges for John to take on as he moves on to the Chief Medical Officer of the National Center for HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. Another positive to this is we now in the division and in STD prevention across the nation now have another staunch advocate at the center level for the work that we do. And for those of you that don't remember, Dr. Kevin Fenton came to CDC through the Division of STD Prevention as well. So we're very fortunate to have that. Some of the negative things are very obvious as to what's going to be a problem for me. Most specifically, a reduced amount of time interacting with John on the things that are very important to us. I will still have opportunities to work with him, as I do with Kevin, but my daily interactions will change quite dramatically. With that said, I do have some warnings for my colleagues at the center. Looking at Kevin specifically, you already know this, many folks already know this, but John will never run out of questions. That's a good thing because John is at his core, he is a doctor, he's a scientist, he's a scholar. When I took this job 5 years ago, I'm going to say some things I probably shouldn't say, but I'm going to say them fast so you guys can. I was having some trouble with the number of questions that were coming to me from John, so I called Susan Delisle, who was the acting deputy director for about a year before I took this job. And I said, boy, this guy, he's just asking me so many questions. And my answer almost all the time is, I don't know. And Susan put it into perspective for me. She said, you have to understand John's background and where he is in his life. He is an intellectual kid, an information addict in an intellectual and information candy store. Well, once again, to the center, I'm afraid that John now, as an information addict, has hit the mother load by going onto the center. And I hope that he doesn't overdose on all the information that he has. I'm saying all these things from my personal perspective because John and I, like I said, we've had a partnership for the past 5 years. I will say one more little anecdote personally. To understand my perspective, I'm a manager, a supervisor, a leader of a number of folks. When they call in sick to me, I never ask, what are your symptoms? I don't want to know. All I want to know is when you're going to come back, what I can do to help you. When I called John about 2 years ago to say, I'm not feeling well, he turned into a doctor. And he started asking me all sorts of questions. Well, I will tell you, one of the things that has just stuck with me and will stick with me for the rest of my life, he diagnosed me over the phone with pneumonia. And he was right. So the questions are really good. They can turn into really good information for you. But from my personal perspective, or from my personal standpoint, I'd like to say, John, thank you. I appreciate all of your intelligence, your collegiality, your leadership, all the guidance you've provided me, the trust you put in me, and the commitment to the public health practice that we all do, and to the people that we serve, and most of all for your friendship. I'm really happy to see you evolve your career, but I'm very, very sad to see you moving 200 yards away so that I don't see you every day. But that's from me. Now, from the Division of STD Prevention, I've been asked to also provide John with just a small token of our appreciation. And since I haven't had time to prepare for this, I'm just going to read it. It says, presented to John M. Douglas, Jr., we, the staff of the Division of STD Prevention at CDC, thank you for 7 years of outstanding public service as our division director. Your commitment to public health, your integrity, your compassion for the underserved, your extraordinary work ethic, and your respect for staff is an inspiration. We are confident that your research and programmatic expertise will continue to advance the nation's health. So on behalf of the Division of STD Prevention, thank you, John, for all you've done.
So, Darren, don't go away. I got a couple of questions for you. And this is unbelievably, amazingly gesture. I'm speechless. All I have is questions. I can't. Why didn't you tell me you were doing this? I sent an email out a couple of weeks ago when I announced that I was, as I put it to a couple of people, graduating from the division. It took me 7 years to get through as opposed to 4 years. But it's been an amazing ride. I mean, just extraordinarily amazing. As I said in my farewell note, when I told my wife and my son we're moving to Atlanta, and they said, what? I said, we're going to public health Mecca. And, it's really turned out to be that way. It just absolutely has turned out to be that way. It's not just the biggest public health agency in the world, it's just the greatest. And it's been such an extraordinary privilege to be part of this. Darren's right. Man, it's like being in a candy store. And while I'm really looking forward to the work at the center, it's, hey, Ron, I want to talk to you about the lab stuff, or Charlotte about health services, et cetera, et cetera. I could not have asked for a greater, more wonderful, more committed, smarter, funnier, more irreverent group of colleagues than I've worked with in the division. They are just the best, and I've done my own satisfaction surveys across the agency, and I'm here to tell you unequivocally, evidence-based, this is the best division at CDC. Now, that's saying nothing about my new divisional colleagues at the center, Kevin, but you guys are the best. And you are tied in being the best, a little bit like the Jack Spencer Award, by working with the best group of public health colleagues in the country, bar none. As Bill Foege said the first night, folks don't go into this field for remuneration. They don't go into it for celebrity. They don't go into it for glory. They go into it because it's incredibly important work. It happens to be interesting, but it just really needs to be done. And where there aren't sufficient resources to get it done, as you all know well, you just keep working harder and smarter and doing more innovative things. And that's what this conference was really all about. So, thanks. Thanks for the memories. Thanks for the ride. It's been terrific. And my the sweetness balance of the part of this for me is the fact that I will get to continue working with so many of you as we convince Dr. Frieden of the evidence base for sexual health, and as we take advantage of what Congress will, according to Jeff Levy, do by the end of March, which is to pass health care reform legislation. So thanks to all of you, and keep up doing the amazing work that you do. So now I wear the different hat, and that's to close the conference with Jeannie. There are lots of folks to thank at the end, and that's really what I want to do now. You know, I've heard, I don't know, maybe a dozen people tell me, this has been an incredibly great conference. This conference is always really good, as Jeannie just said, but gosh, this is like maybe the best ever. It's been absolutely terrific. And you know, we were worried about whether folks are going to be able to get here, travel budgets are in bad shape, you know, we didn't set a new world's record in terms of numbers, although we did incredibly well. Final registration count, 1,284 of us doing great stuff together for the past 4 days. But we sure hit a new record in terms of enthusiasm, innovation, and great energy happening. So a couple of last thank yous. First of all, thank you on behalf of Judy Lipschutz and a program in Niger that will be using your donated bags to help with school supplies. And if any of you are prepared, I'm feeling a little torn personally, but prepared to part with your memento of this great conference. Judy's got a great home for it in a very short order. I want to issue thanks to the advisory committee. Man, what a great group of people. Someone was saying, oh, John, you did a great talk. It was really good. And, you know, what I talked about was the advisory committee sat in and said, this is what you ought to talk about. Now, you know, all that surveillance stuff is nice and all that syphilis elimination. Talk about these two topics. And then we'd like to edit your slides as well. But, so I stuck with the first but not the second, and they really hit a home run for me. They were terrific. The fact that this stuff gelled as well as it did, that we had such great symposia, it's due to the work of this amazing committee. So I just want to, I'd like to have the advisory committee stand up, and I really want to personally have all of us clap for them. So if you're on the advisory committee, please stand and let us embarrass you. I want to also thank our organizational partners. Jeannie sitting up here with me as a representative as the president of ASTDA, but this was a quadripartite partnership. Lynn Barkley of the American Social Health Association. And Peter Leone and the new executive director of NCSD, Bill Smith, were fabulous, just absolutely fabulous. You know, we are so lucky. We have relatively few partners that are like totally committed to STD prevention, but when you have partners made of gold, you don't need that many. We're incredibly blessed. I want to thank the extraordinarily tireless work of probably the most unsung heroes of all, that is CDC's Internal Planning Committee. And I'd like to call their names, and if they're here, some of them are out like working, so they can't be here, but Scott Bryan, Lumbe Davis, Melinda Flock, Lauren Green, Suzanne Hacker, Catherine Koski. You were asked to stand, Melinda, and stay standing. Darren Ogburn, Brenda Sullivan, Natasha Thompson, and Terry Winook. And I want to give a special shout out to Catherine Koski, who's over there shyly on the right of the auditorium, for not only being on the Internal Planning Committee, but really pulling together the VD exhibit at the CDC. It was an amazingly great Watsonian reception the other night, and if those of you who didn't make it still have time to, it is well worth a stop before you leave Atlanta. I'd like to offer particularly special thanks to two people who, you know, worked like round the clock for the last several weeks to make this happen. Pam Gorman. Pam told me she was going to turn her name tag inside out because sometimes Pam has to turn down our exuberant funding requests, but this conference would not have happened without Pam. Pam, are you here? Pam is standing, and let's give Pam a hand. And I can see her big smile from here. I want to thank Brenda Kelly for her tireless efforts. Brenda was involved in every aspect of the conference planning committee. I was trying to get a book chapter done about 3 weeks ago. Brenda, please, I've got to get this done. No way, I'm working on the conference. So I had to like enter all my references myself. But, you know, first things first. So big thanks to Brenda. And then finally, my last and deepest thanks to the person who more than any other was responsible for making this conference such an incredible success. Again, I have heard so many of you, even with all the problems we face, comment about how uplifting this conference actually has been. I couldn't agree with you more. And as we close, I want to ask all of us to let Judy Lipschutz know how much we appreciate her extraordinary efforts. Judy, you. So Judy gets to stand here with me and be tortured for a minute. Genius in residence for an unbelievably superb, and by unbelievably superb, I mean each national STD prevention conference we've had since 1996 has been better than the one before it. Now, how do you do that? How do you just keep making it get better and better? This one is number 8. And in commemoration of this incredible array of efforts, we have a special token of gratitude for Judy. Now, I thought about getting Judy a really nice bouquet of flowers. We've worked together on our four conferences. They've all been just stellar. And this is the first one we've been in Atlanta. She could have actually taken them home and put them in water. They wouldn't have wilted. But I had a great team working with me who said, we have a better idea. And Judy, in commemoration of all you've done, we have pulled together a commemorative of an array of logos. Now, these are the covers from each of the 8 conferences: Tampa 96, Dallas 98, Milwaukee 2000, San Diego 2002, Jacksonville 06, Chicago 08, and now the big ATL in 2010. Now, this design is sort of inspired by that of a quilt. I was up at Asha a couple of weeks ago, and they had an AIDS quilt on their wall. I thought, what a great design. And we had an amazing array of Santa's elves in our office. Melinda, Darren, Brenda, and Ron Noose, who pulled this tribute together. So, Judy, on behalf of not only this conference, but this amazing array, this almost, if you will, career award of conference planning, we thank you, knowing, as always, as stated right here, that the best is yet to come. Okay, well, I can't top that. So I want to thank everybody again for an amazing conference, for amazing involvement, personally for your friendship and collegiality to me. And be well, do good work, and stay in touch, and let's eliminate STDs. Safe travels.